Oasis Podcast, episode 14, Paulo Hewitt. Welcome to the Oasis Podcast, episode 14. They're coming for thick and fast now. I've got Tony McCarroll's episode sitting ready to release. And and I know people really, really want to hear it. So, so I'm just getting these other ones out sort of as quick as I can, really, to get Tony's out. So Tony's is next, but we're not going to skip this one because this one's completely fantastic as well, which is with Paulo Hewitt. Now, Paulo Hewitt is a big hero of mine as a fan of the mod movement and a fan of his various books over the years, particularly his work on Oasis. Paulo Hewitt's just been there, as I talked about in the episode, so I won't repeat it here. But, yeah, absolute legend to get to speak to Paulo Hewitt. It's amazing. So that is coming up. A few bits of news and housekeeping, as we usually do over here at Oasis Podcast. Another crazy few days. So the last episode I released on the early hours of Friday morning. It is now Tuesday night, and there's been more news literally in these last few days. So the biggest thing was that we got to see Liam on the telly, and not just sort of live streaming people on Periscope and stuff, but actually properly on the telly at the One Love Manchester show. So that was fantastic to see him there. Let's have a little bit of this here. So yeah, amazing to see Liam on the TV. I was in the kitchen tidying up or something, and then there's a funny one. I'd been kind of keeping a check on Twitter and keeping a check on things because the rumours were that he was going to be there, but you kind of didn't think he would be, really. You know, you didn't think it would. I put a Twitter poll on the At Oasis Podcast page saying, right, who do we think is going to turn up? Liam, Noel, both of them, and they duet on Acquiesce, or Alan White, Gwigsy, and Scott McLeod, and it was Liam. So the answer was Liam, and people did, I think about 60% of people thought it would be, actually. So great to see him. And then Noel wasn't. Noel was on a yacht sunning himself, looking pretty trim, to be fair, for a 50-year-old. But and he didn't. And then Liam's given him some abuse on Twitter about that. Which, I don't know, some people could say that's quite insensitive considering everything that's going on at the moment, but hey, it's Liam, what are you going to expect? So and what I thought was quite funny though was then Lisa Moorish, who he had a child with, then came back and had a massive go at Liam, basically saying he's never even met his daughter, whereas Noel is apparently plays a big part in her life. But anyway, it's all a bit EastEnders for me. The cool thing was, it was great to see Liam at the show. Yeah, it would have been great if Noel was there as well, but hey, one Gallagher brother's better than none, definitely. So the tracks that Liam did at the One Love Manchester gig are now on Spotify, so you can go and listen to those to your heart's content. Hear Johnny Buckland's dodgy impression of Noel Gallagher, and Chris Martin's dodgy falsetto, You and I Can Live Forever. And also, Liam's done another festival. He's done one called Pink Pop, and there he did a couple of the new songs, and they were recorded in pretty decent quality. So let's have a listen to a little bit of Greedy Soul. She got a 666. I got a crucifix. Yeah, she's got a spinning head. Likes the ungrateful dead. You're gonna tell. You're gonna sign. couple of other bits. So the if you head over to the Patreon page, there's a couple of new articles up there. I did a blog post. I've been typically doing one of those a month now, so we are now officially 2 months into the podcast. So that is the second blog post has just gone up there, sort of covering off, just telling the story really of how this last month has gone and how I've managed to get hold of a couple of those guests that we had and what we've got in the pipeline and stuff like that. So that was really good fun to do. So have a read of that. Also, you'll see another article up there called Noise and Confusion, number one. And that's written by a chap called Richard Bowes, who is at RickyB123 on Twitter. He got in touch with me a little while ago and sort of said he'd be interested in helping out with the podcast. And turns out he's got a bit of a music journalism background and happy to do some writing. So great. So we agreed that he'd do a few blog posts. And that Patreon page is as good a place as any. You can upload all kinds of stuff on there. So that'll be the de facto place for posts that he does, that I do, and anyone else that's out there. If you fancy writing some articles, or it's Oasis related stuff or similar, then get in touch. You know, that's fine. As we said, we're all about the community, and whatever you want to do, we'll have a look at it. So anyway, yeah, go and check that out on the Patreon page. And the other Patreon related thing that I'm really, really happy with is we have now completed our first Patreon reward song. As you'll see over on Patreon, if you support the podcast at more than the $3 a month mark, I've said that I will write and record you a bespoke song. Now, the first person to do that was Casey Bennett, who appeared in episode 3 from the movie Multiverse podcast. And so what I did is I got back in touch with my old childhood friend, Joel Cliff, who's my who's best man at my wedding, and same for me for him. And yeah, and so it was great to do a bit of recording with Joel. So what I did is I sort of put like a scratchy bit of a demo together on GarageBand, just with some shoddily put together lyrics relating to the movie Multiverse podcast. And then Joel basically took that and created this, well, what I think is a really, really good song. And then he sent it back over to me. I've done my sort of best dodgy Liam impression over the top of it. And I've played it to Casey. He's really happy with it. So that's what it's all about. Anyway, I'm going to play this to you now. So this is, might feel a bit indulgent, but this is the Oasis podcast with Across the Multiverse. We'll be right back. So yeah, if anyone wants to get in touch and say don't give up podcasting, that's fine. I would completely understand. But yeah, that was really good fun to do. So thank you so much, Casey, for signing up at that level. If you want your own bespoke song, then as I say, you can sign up at $3 a month level. If we get completely inundated with requests, then we might need to change that, or we might need to put a time limit on that, because it actually took a lot of work to put that together. But anyway, we'll see how that goes. If that's something you'd be interested in, head over to patreon.com/oasispod and sign up at the $3 per month level or more, and that will get you a song. I will be doing some stuff on there, whether it's posts that I do or posts that Richard does or anyone else. And some of them we may end up putting for Patreon only, exclusively for the first sort of, say, 2 weeks, something like that. It's just, if people are willing to throw a couple of quid our way every month, then I think you should have something a little bit extra for them. So we're not saying there'll be anything not coming to everyone else, but yeah, maybe just something a little bit special, but we'll just see how that goes. The other thing as well is that you'll see we are now on Audio Boom, and so you will have heard a lovely advert at the start of this episode, 30 seconds worth of something telling you about something interesting. Yes, we are now part of that network. There is advertising at the start. If you abhor advertising and you don't want to listen to it, that's absolutely fine. Sign up at the $1 a month level or above, and I will email you every episode as an MP3. Without adverts, you can listen to it to your heart's content, so that's fine. A couple of quick shout outs. I forgot to do this last time, but I got to 500 followers, and I was sat on 499 followers on Twitter, this is. And I was sat there for ages, and it felt like a footballer, you know, when they're playing and they're trying to get their 100th goal or whatever, and it's just not coming. So I just put it out there and said, come on, guys, can someone follow me, please? At least let me get over 500. And at Mick and Siv stepped up. He's prodded his missus, who is Alana, who is at Alana R. Prentice. And so she followed me. So she became my 500th follower. So thank you so much to those guys. It knocked me over the 500 mark. I think I'm now over about 650. And that, I think, is primarily thanks to Oasis Munoz, who is she still hasn't found a husband, if you can remember that, all the way back in episode 4. But yeah, she's been a great supporter of the podcast and very big advocate for us. And also over on Instagram, champagne_supersonic, thank you so much. You wrote a lovely post. And then that's suddenly driven loads of people to follow me on Instagram, which is a little bit annoying because I'm having to like flip between Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and Live Forever Forum and Reddit and all over the place. I wish everyone just go in one place, please. That'd be good. Thank you. So one other newsy thing, the Wall of Glass single was available as a vinyl. It was like a 500 limited edition, and it sold out straight away. And a few people on my Twitter were sort of quite frustrated about that because they wanted to get it and they didn't even know it was out. And so thank you to David Duggan 81 because he dropped me a quick heads up that it was available, and he sent me the link over. I put it out there on the Twitter, and so I think those of you that wanted that could go and grab it. I don't know if it's still there, but if you look back on my Twitter, you'll see that, or follow at David Duggan 81 and get your hands on a vinyl Wall of Glass single. A really cool video was put together by at 19freddy05, which was Liam Gallagher Rock Icon 1994 to 2017. And he pinged it over to me, and I shared it, and a lot of other people shared it as well. It's gone a bit viral. It's done about 5,000 likes and about 2,500 retweets, and it's over on YouTube doing great numbers as well. And it's a comparison of Liam from the One Love Manchester gig doing Live Forever compared to the 1994 Live Forever acoustic with Noel on acoustic and Bonehead on keyboard from MTV. And so that's really interesting. So let's drop a bit of that in here. Maybe I just wanna fly, wanna live, but don't wanna die. Maybe I just wanna breathe. Maybe I just don't believe. Maybe you're the same as me. We see things I'll never Okay, and the last thing before we go into the interview with Paolo Hewitt, got a three more iTunes reviews, or three more that I've seen anyway. The first is on the American site, which is by Embrace UK One, which says, great podcast, amazing podcast, great guests, great listen and reflecting for us who lived through the Britpop years and after. So thank you very much for Embrace UK for doing that. And also there's a couple more on the UK site, which are by @Danielle19, who also got in touch on Twitter. So thank you very much for getting in touch, Danielle. Best podcast ever. Really awesome podcast with great insight into all things Oasis. A must for all fans. Thanks for getting this going. Live forever. So that's awesome. Great. Thanks, Danielle. And the last one, About Time. Manualfi. It's about time we had a podcast devoted to Oasis. Really interesting with some great guests. If you're a hardcore fan, then this is the podcast for you. Great work. And that's actually from Bonehead's Barber. And the very final thing to mention is that 17th of June in Northampton, we will be there. What's the Story, playing great Oasis tunes from 10 o'clock at night until 3 o'clock in the morning. So come on down. Contact me on Twitter for details. Anyway, enough of this. After this brief musical interlude, it's me with Paolo Hewitt. How are you doing?
I'm good, good, thank you. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Yeah, it was a real pleasure to, you know, to have you on the podcast. It's it's similar to Brian Cannon for me, in that you were just one of those people when I just went full headfirst into Oasis and Britpop and delving back into the history of music. You were one of those guys that sort of, you know, helped me on that journey, definitely. So I'll always be
kind of you, thank you.
Well,
thank you. That's cheered my Saturday up.
Well, there you go. Well, that's I mean, that was, you know, that was an important thing, and we we were in a band.
It was an important thing, and I was very, you know, I was very fortunate to be there at that time. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I met the band in '94, so it was a great time. They just started the ascent into, you know, superstardom, and it was just brilliant to be there and watch it all unfold. You know, it was a unique experience, and I'm very, very grateful for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, you were there, and it's, you know, and I think that, you know, especially getting high was, I mean, we all had that, you know, that was like the sort of the Bible really for us.
Oh, thank you.
And even in
I put a lot into that, man. Jesus.
Yeah. Was that hard work?
God. Yeah, it was a lot of hard work, because what it was first of all, I knew it was sort of like, how do I put it? It wasn't an open goal, but it was like, I've got to put this into the back of the net, because if I miss this, if I don't do this correctly, it would be such a missed opportunity. Because I was there, you know, I think I call one of the chapters In the Eye of the Storm, which was a George Harrison quote, I think. And so I was there in that storm, so I would never, ever, ever again be in that storm. You know, I would never, ever witness anything, so I had to get it absolutely right. So there was a bit of pressure. And also I was doing things like, like the conversations that go on. That was me running back to my hotel room at like 4 in the morning and scribbling down everything I could remember. And then, of course, waking up next day and looking at my notes and not being able to read one word of them, because my handwriting's so bad, and probably had a couple of shandies. So, there was a lot of that going on. And it took me a year. I remember I started in January of, what year did that come out? 97? Yeah, 97, wasn't it? I think I started it, I think it was 97, and I started in 96. Yeah, I started it in 96.
Right.
And I wrote from January to October, and I was working like, you know, 10, 15 hour days, you know.
Well, I suppose when you've got a band...
One... Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, when you've got a band that are just in that peak of the ascendancy, I suppose, with the publisher just like, get it out now, you know?
Yeah. Well, they were, but the thing was, Oasis were just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like, you know, there was no sense of them at that time peaking at all, you know? I mean, it's Nebworth that year, so, you know, and it was just, it was only, I think, I mean, probably 98, 99 that it started to wind down a bit, but I think, so there was a lot of pressure on to get that correct. And, you know, from the reviews and from what people have written to me, it seems like I managed to put the ball in the net. So that's great. You know?
No, absolutely. And because it was a an eye of the storm, you know, it's someone who's physically there experiencing it with them. But, you know, putting it into words better than they probably could, because they're not kind of, you know, educated sort of book writing type guys. Although
they're musicians. They play music to a very large amount of people, which in itself is a huge skill. So that's what they did. And I mean, what I did was I DJed on tour with them. You see,
okay,
which was a really smart move. Because what it did was, if I'd gone on tour with them as the writer, if I walked into the dressing room, they would shut up.
Yeah.
And go, all right, the writer's here. But they didn't, because they thought I was powerless as a DJ. They kind of forgot I was writing a book, because they couldn't see me actually doing it. Because like I'd say, I'd, you know, at the end of each night, I'd go back to the hotel room and write down everything I remembered. So there wasn't a sense of, oh, be quiet, he's here. It was like, oh, there's Paolo, he's the DJ.
Yeah. Oh, that's really good. You know, that makes, I know you're a big football guy, and that makes me think of, you know that footballers are just the biggest kind of jokers and piss takers and like hooligans. And yet, as soon as a camera goes on them, they just become like frightened schoolboys, right? And they're just sat there like, well, you know, and they just come out with the cliche.
They're drilled in it.
Yeah.
I mean, look, watch Imagine Today and count it, and how many times somebody comes on who's scored some wonder goal, and they go, what an amazing goal, Harry Kane. And Harry will go, yes, thank you very much, but the most important thing was the team got 3 points today.
I know. So
you watch how many times, and they're drilled in it, you know.
Yeah. And yet,
with musicians, they're, you know, obviously far looser, and, but, you know, so any kind of, you know, there was a lot of rows going on, a lot of fighting. So, you know, if I was there for that, it wasn't calmed down. Oh, don't do this in front of him. You know, it just, everything just evolved organically, you know.
And was there much of a, oh no, you can't put that out, or you can't say they were taking drugs, or you can't say, it was just like, no, fine.
No. Funny enough, with Forever the People, there was a hint of, you know, the drug thing is boring now, blah blah blah. By then it was a different kettle of fish, because you see that tour, that Be Here Now tour, was a slog. It wasn't fun anymore, and I think I say in Forever the People, suddenly all they kept talking about was, you know, 10 years previous, being stuck in some van going up to Leeds to play at One Man and His Dog, and, you know, getting caught by the police, or, you know, shenanigans, or, you know, just that. Because suddenly it felt like it was just a job, it was just a slog. And it was funny, because I'd been on tours before. I think everything leading up to Nebworth was just magical, and I think after Nebworth it started to become something completely different to what it had been.
Yeah.
Fun kind of went from it, really.
Yeah. Well, I've got Matt Whitecross, director of Supersonic, coming on in a bit. And
lovely guy.
Oh, good. And he, and like I've heard him in other interviews sort of saying, you know, when people have said, well, why did you stop at Nebworth? And, you know, it's, well, with every band, the journey to get there is always the most interesting bit, you know.
Absolutely. And the journey upwards... It's the most exciting bit. Once you get to the top, once you've achieved, well, you know, I said to you, he didn't use it, Matt, but I said this line to him. The trouble with Oasis was they had all these dreams about being huge rock and roll stars, and they wrote records called Rock and Roll Star, you know, about those desires, and that they wanted to live in big houses and sleep with amazing looking women and take the best drugs and they drink the finest champagne. You know, they wanted that classic rock style thing, and they got it. And once they got it, they didn't know what to do because they'd achieved their dreams. And what I said to Matt was, what you have to do somehow is go back to bed and dream up another load of dreams, and then follow them. But you know, by then it was just too late, and it was a crazy, you know. I mean, what, half a million people went out bought, over half a million people went out bought BNL on the first day of release.
Yeah.
Just craziness, you
madness.
Know. Yeah, it was absolute madness. And I think it kind of, and then, like they say in that documentary, you know, suddenly they were surrounded by a lot of men with man bags, you know. You've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And, you know, I remember thinking after Nebworth, you should Sunday night Nebworth should have just said, you know what, that's it, see you later.
Yeah.
And then it would have gone down in history. It would have just been amazing. But instead it kind of slowly kind of disintegrated, didn't it?
Well, that's the same as the Jam, isn't it, right? So the Jam did exactly that. They walked away, and Weller did something completely different, and then it was just done, you know, never gone back to it. And I think that's one of the great things about Weller, that whole just never go back, keep moving forwards. Now the Jam have been cemented as this burn so bright, exactly the same as the Smiths, you know, like burn bright, done, you know, that's what you want.
But
nice one. Well, just taking it back a bit, pal, I mean, it's sort of funny, we often do these sort of go back and your childhood and things like that, but I mean, in your case, anyone who knows your stuff and has bought your books and stuff kind of knows it, because it's you know you've written a couple of excellent books sort of about your growing up, but yeah, you didn't have the most sort of conventional nuclear family upbringing, let's just put it that way.
I would disagree with that. Didn't everybody end up in a nursery at the end of age of 2 days old? Joking, aren't you? No, it was a bit of a mad one, but my mother was in a hospital, and she'd had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and basically, if it hadn't today, she would have been out in 3 months. But in those unenlightened days, she put in a hospital, and she lived there for 40 years, and anyway, she had an affair with someone in the hospital, and that was me, so I was taken away from her. Pardon me. After 2 days, and I was placed in care. When I was four, I was adopted, fostered, actually, because they never got to adopt me. The one good thing is my mother never signed the adoption forms. The family adopted me was run by this woman who made Maggie Thatcher look like Florence Nightingale. I mean, this woman was crazy. You know, she'd lock me in cupboards and blah, blah, blah. So it was a really, really unhappy childhood. But there was one really good bit. One Sunday, I presume it must have been about October 63. I'm just basing that on the release of the record She Loves You by the Beatles, because I heard it on the radio, and it was like, I can still remember now, it just feels magical. It was just, it completely and utterly captivated me. I was just, all day long, I just walked around going, she loves you, yeah. I was just, and that started my love affair with music. And I was also a good reader. And so books and music were kind of my way out of what was, you know, this very harrowing situation I was in. Books and music were my, and football as well, actually. And I look back on it now, when I wrote The Looked After Kid, which was my first book about growing up in care, I realised the reason I took to them so much was because they placed me in the present. When you're playing football, when you're listening to music, when you're reading a book, you're not in the past, you're not in the future, you're actually in the present. And if it's a great book, and if it's a great record, when it's an absorbing game of football, then you're absolutely taken, you're captivated by it.
Absolutely.
So it's a release from, you know, what was going on, and that's why music and books are so important to me. When I was 10, she threw me out of the house and put me back into care, and I spent my formative years, 10 till 18, at a children's home in Woking called Burbank, which an experience I look back on very fondly. I think it gave me, I wrote about this in my second book, But We All Shine On, which was that it gave me, I realised that it gave me a lot of really good qualities. Loyalty. You know, when people arrived at the home, there was this kind of recognition, you know, that something bad had happened to this person. And so I became very non-judgmental. Anybody who walked through that door, it didn't matter whether they were boy, girl, you know, coloured, whatever. It didn't matter, do you know what I mean, of any colour. It didn't matter because they were in the same boat as us. So, you know, it gave me that. And also, I was very lucky because when I was 14, I walked into school and a friend of mine, Enzo, was reading The Enemy. And I said to him, what's this? And he went, it's The Enemy. And I said, what on earth is that? And he went, well, it's New Musical Express. It's a paper about music. I just couldn't believe that was a paper about music. I was just fascinated by it. And the light bulb came on. I thought, that's what I want to do. That's it. That's what I want to do. So I was very lucky, so I had that to aim for. But because I was in a children's home, I didn't really have anybody telling me I couldn't do it. Do you know what I mean? I think my parents going, no, you're going to go to university, or you're going to
get a proper job,
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Exactly, get a proper job. I've been looking for one of those the last 40 years. So the children's home actually gave me a lot of good things, you know. So, but I left there when I was 19, 20. I left when I was 18. I lived with a good friend, Mon Pete Garland, so I was there. 1920, and then I moved up to London because, you know, in Woking they sort of have bylaws against you becoming a writer. They don't like it, so I knew I had to get to London to achieve my dream. So I came up to London and I joined the college, and I joined the college's paper, and I wrote for that paper. And one day I went to Camden to be present by the Enemy, and the Enemy wasn't there. They'd sold out, and I spent 10 minutes saying this guy, come on, you must have a copy somewhere. And in the end, he sold me Melody Maker. And it was all, oh, God, because Melody Maker then was just, you know, compared to the Enemy, this is like hanging out with your great granny. You know, the Enemy was like hanging out with your mates and the factory on the bike shed. This is like going around your granny's for tea or something. It's just horrible. And I was an ad said young writers wanted. So I sent them in what I'd written for the student paper. And on Friday, I was in the office of Richard Williams, editor. And he started giving me, you know, live reviews to do and stuff like that. And it grew from there, really.
That is phenomenal, isn't it? So that was just it. There was no sort of you hawking your stuff around town for years. It was just bump, first entry and straight in.
I know, but you know what I think what it is, James, is I think it's about if you're obsessed with something big enough, you will get it. I think, you know, we're talking about Oasis, Noel was obsessed, they were all obsessed with making it huge. Not just making it, but making it huge.
Yeah.
And if you put enough into it, if you really, you know, I've got a book coming out this year about, it's an open letter to my son, Rafi, and I was talking about this in there. If you really, really want it, you know, and you're obsessed with it, you know, like I was obsessed with the NMEs. Therefore, because I was obsessed with the NME, I was at Camden Tube when they didn't have one for me to buy Melody Maker. Do you know what I mean? All those kind of things, which, you know, are luck, are also about obsession, about what, you know, what it will drive you to do. You know, I've done anything. You know, so I got to join the Enemy in 1983. So, you know, you can. I think it's about mind power, as James Brown would say. Yeah. I really do think that.
Yeah.
Well, and I just think I was very lucky to have that. I'm a huge fan of Robert De Niro, and I was watching an interview with him, and the guy said to him, "Oh, yeah, De Niro went, I'm very lucky." And the guy went, "Well, you're not very lucky. You know, you put all this research into your roles and you really worked." And he said, "Yeah, but I had that instinct to do that, you know, and that's what I had. I had that instinct. I want to become an NME writer, you know." And that's how I got to do it, you know. And I just think it's that mind power thing. I really do.
Yeah. And I think it's coming from, you know, people that come from working class backgrounds as well, because, like, you know, so many of the great footballers, great musicians, great writers have had to do it, you know. And I think that sort of, you know, I'm sort of from rural Oxfordshire, and it just sort of, you know, there's no one of any note has ever come from my town, which is Didcot. When you look on Wikipedia, famous people from Didcot, it's like, you know, tumbleweed. And it's because, you know, it's a pretty nice place and there's work. You get into Oxford, you can get into London, you get into Reading, and like, you know, so there isn't that same desire and thrust that, you know, like the Oasis guys had, that, look, if we're not going to make it as a footballer or a musician, you're basically going to be working in a factory or on the dole or dealing drugs, and that's it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing was, for me, was I kind of thought to myself, I mean, there was a lot of insecurity that went with it, because I had no idea if I was any good as a writer. I really didn't, and it took me years and years, even people going to me, that was a brilliant article, because I'd so, because of my upbringing, I kind of had quite a lot of low self-esteem. I didn't kind of believe it, but the thing I thought myself was, I've got to try this. You know, the worst thing in the world, I think, would be to go to be lying on your deathbed and go, I wish I'd tried to become a writer, or wish I'd tried to join a band, or wish, do you know what I mean? At least if I failed, I could, you know, go back to working with my child between my legs and go and work in the library or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, fair enough. And so,
but knowing, I tried it, and, you know, I didn't cut it, but at least I tried, gave it a shot.
At least you gave it a go. Yeah, exactly. No, fair enough. And so was it, so you mentioned it was like the Beatles, and then what about sort of going on from the Beatles, once you're into your kind of teenage years, what bands was it, or artists that really turned you on around them?
For me, the 70s, it was Graham Parker and the Rumour. In the 80s, it was in the 70s as well, the Faces. The Faces were huge for me as well. The Faces and Graham Parker and the Rumour. And then in the 80s, Dexys Midnight Runners. And in the 90s, Shaq.
Shaq? Oh, wow. I haven't thought about Shaq for a while. They were an incredible band.
Oh, love them. Absolutely love them. Yes. But not put a couple of albums out, didn't he, on his label?
Yeah. That's great.
No, I love Shaq. In fact, I took my oldest son Shaq down at the Astoria.
Oh, cool.
It's funny, because that's the second time I saw Oasis. The first time I saw him was at the Kentish Town Forum.
Well, I was going to say, what was the first sort of your first introduction to Oasis then, either hearing the music or live or meeting them?
It was sort of one of those things where it was word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I'll tell you what it was. It was Jeff Barrett. I used to hang out with Jeff Barrett, who runs Heavenly Records a lot. And I was around his house, and he went, "Have a listen to this," and it was Live Forever. He told me Live Forever. And I was just thought, "Okay, this is one of the most amazing records I've ever heard." Really did. And then I saw him on, what was that program they were on?
The Word.
Yeah, that was it. I saw him on that and thought, yeah, this is good. But there was this real buzz around London about him. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
It was like that word of mouth. You've got to go and see this band. So we got tickets to the Forum, and it was just great. I mean, they were. The thing that struck me was they were making this huge sound, but nobody was moving on stage.
Mm.
They just stood there staring at the audience, you know. And yet you had this huge sound coming from it. It was quite unique. And then of course Liam and hands behind the back and the vocal style, and you know, it was just wow, you know, you knew it was something, you know, something.
Yeah. And what about meeting them for the first time, Paolo, and sort of getting in, as I say, as a DJ initially?
No one knew me because I'd written a book about the Jam, because obviously he was a huge fan of them, and so he came up and said hello, and that was it. But then he called me up a couple of weeks later and invited me round to his flat in Fulham. He was staying at Johnny Marr's flat in Fulham.
Oh, yeah.
and we went round there, and that's when I first got to know. They were watching this, they'd done this interview with Gary Crowley.
Yeah.
And they were just watching, Noel was watching it endlessly. Because it was, they'd given him all the outtakes, you know, the full interview.
I mean, could you believe, though, that in a way that it was so easy? I mean, I'm sure there's probably a lot of, you know, people are watching this who are in bands who have been, you know, banging out the tapes to record companies for years.
It's not easy. And, like, people go, oh, yeah, well, I'm... It's not easy. Someone asked me, how did we go about and get this deal? And, we didn't go out anyway. It was just one of them things. And we're lucky enough that it happened. Hurrah! You know,
anyway, can I say something now?
No.
My name's Noel.
One of them things.
I write all the songs.
You know, you walk down the road, you trip over, you break your leg, and you're gutted. You know, one of them things,
or somebody
like,
breaks
do a gig for four, you know, do four songs, and he comes up and takes us away. I'm after it, oh, what a big star.
So he was kind of obsessing over that, and then we got talking about Beatles and football and whatever. And then Noel moved to Camden, and I was in a place called Crouch End at the time, which is quite near. So I started going over to his little flat in Camden, yeah. And we'd watch the football or, you know, talk or, you know, all the rest of it.
Nice one. What about the other guys, or was it mainly Noel that was you're good mates with?
It was Noel that I first got to know, and I was probably closest to. And then, obviously, going on the road, I met the rest of them. Liam was very standoffish with me. I think he saw me as something. You know, he was very suspicious of anybody, really, in those days. So, which is fair enough. I understood that totally. So. Quixie was lovely. And Bonehead and, Alan Wyatt had just come in. They're lovely guys, you know, really, really funny. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun then. The thing was, they had this kind of, you know, everything was new. You know, we're going on tour in Japan. Japan, yeah, you're going to Japan. Oh, it's amazing. You know, 4 years later, going to Japan. Oh, I'll stay in that shit hotel again, aren't we? You know. At that time, everything was brand new and it was all groovy and, you know, they were, you know, it was just incident, adventure after adventure, you know.
Yeah.
Noel would come back and say, you know, oh, I've got stopped at the border. You know, we had to hide everything in there. I mean, it was just all this stuff, you know. And it was just funny. It was just really, really funny. And he was just, his writing, he was just on... He was on one of those streaks, you know, that like everything he was writing was, you know, had value to it. Not, you know, I would say, you know, some songs weren't as effective as others or as big or as epic, but even the little ones had something about them, you know. He was just on this incredible roll, really. I think he'd been waiting and waiting for so long that when he saw his chance, he just took it, you know, with both hands. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
They weren't gonna mess this one up, you know.
Mm.
But they had no idea how big they were going to get. I remember Noel saying to me when Morning Glory was still selling after a year, he said, you know, I thought we were going to replace the Stone Roses. That's what the idea was.
Mm.
They were going to replace the Stone Roses and become the Stone Roses, you know. And have their audience, you know, it is a sizable audience, but it wasn't you know, the worldwide phenomenon that they became.
Mm. No, good. And then I have to ask you, Paul, because the crazy thing about this, and one of the big spurs for me starting this podcast, was that there's a lot of good stuff written around their first few years. And like we were saying, yeah that is the key point. But there's been nothing that's been a career retrospective of Oasis. There isn't a book, unless, you know, there's a little self-published one. There isn't one. And and I was sort of in a recent episode, I was talking to this American author, Ken Womack, who writes on the Beatles primarily. And I was sort of saying this to him, and he said, well, go and write one. And I went, what? I'm not going to write one. But Paolo, I ran it as a poll on my Twitter. And I said, right, we need a career retrospective book. Who should write it? Me, Paolo, I think Paul, Martha, and someone that I can't remember who the other one. And you came out like 80%. So the public is speaking. Go and write that book, mate.
Well, you see, that's very kind, and thank you to everyone. But the most important thing was that we got 3 points today. The thing is, right, is that it's not as interesting. Do you know what I mean?
I mean,
it just, it just became a machine, Oasis.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, once Quigsy and Bone had left, it was like when Ronnie Lane, I don't know if you, if your listeners know who the Faces were.
Yeah, I'd imagine most do.
Ronnie Lane, when Ronnie Lane left the Faces, that was the end of them. They went on for another 2 years.
Mm.
But that was the end of the Faces, really.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and when
yeah.
Quigsy and Bone had left, that was the end of Oasis.
Yeah.
The rest was just, you know, I mean, what I would like is for someone to put up a list of the great tracks from that period.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I don't have to wait for all those albums.
Well, I think, I mean, you know...
Yeah,
people
say that there's really good stuff on...
Well, I've done yesterday I did a Spotify playlist of, like, I tried to make a, there was another poll where we said, right, what's the best Oasis album post Be Here Now?
Because
all of those albums have got good tracks on them, but
yeah,
as I say, there's some, there's some pretty sloggy ones as well that, you know, that
yeah.
just, you just wouldn't, you know, wouldn't have even made it anywhere near a B-side on the early years.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so there's probably 20, 25 that are decent, and you could really make probably one good album that was up there with the others. So I'll tell you
what,
mate.
Send me a list of what that album would be.
I will. I'll ping that over, and then I'll put it out when I come off the phone. I'll put it out on Twitter, and we'll say, right, let's build an album for Paolo. Our hive mind will give you the best Oasis 2000s album, mate. There you go.
Because it's funny, because last night I went to this Sergeant Pepper thing, because it was 50th anniversary of Sergeant Pepper yesterday.
Yeah.
It was a launch party at Bond.
Yeah, I didn't get my invite. I don't know where that must have gone missing in the post.
We were waiting for you, mate. Then you didn't show up. We just carried on. I was thinking this morning that, you see, Sergeant Pepper, I have problems with.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know what? You could actually, the best way to do it sometimes is with bands is years.
Hmm.
Instead of albums, for example, with 1967, Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane came out.
Yeah.
Which any band would put on their next album,
of course,
wouldn't they? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you took off with A Little Help From Your Friends and Within Without You, the thing that goes on forever on side two, or whatever. And then, you know, what an album then. You know, now you start. Do you know what I mean? And if you did it by years, it's probably best. But people did say to me that there was really good stuff hidden away in, you know, these albums, because I couldn't, that Be Here Now tour kind of really, it kind of did my head in a bit, and it just, you know, it just wasn't fun anymore, and, you know, they had become sort of, you know, rock stars.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I thought the idea was not to be rock stars, you know, but.
Yeah,
they'd
become what they set out to destroy, right?
Yeah. You said that.
Yeah, I said that. You didn't say that.
Yeah.
But yeah, because, I mean, when they started out, the mission statement was, you know, to get rid of Phil Collins and, you know...
Didn't bring me the head of Phil Collins.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to put him in the fridge. That's great being a documentary. Yeah. What about that documentary when Liam's doing his baked beans, man?
No.
The baked beans, it's not the can. It's not the bite you bite off, man. It's not the shop you're in. Beans, man.
I know, but that's why we loved them, though, because it was just, you know, they would just come out with stupid stuff like that, and they would.
I'll tell you what. I always thought Liam would make such a great music critic, because I used to read his stuff in The Enemy, and his comments about other bands were just either completely spot on or hilarious.
Yeah.
I can't bring things of any to mind at the moment, but I remember I used to read them in The Enemy and just think, man, you should be a critic.
Yeah.
What they need to do is do it. Yeah, they get a fight. Or whatever, you know.
Well, now he's on Twitter and he's the one person, the two people I log on Twitter to check is Liam and Tyson Fury, right, the boxer.
Okay.
And they're both nutcases who will just come out with, you know, he was having a go at, you know, Noel, he just refers to him as potato and you know, just, you know, he's just brilliant, like just this bizarre little things he says.
Yeah.
And he's the only person on Twitter that follows zero people. Literally zero following. You think, God bless him, man. More people in the world like Liam. But then, as you know, I don't know, maybe you, if you got the brunt of it, as you said, if he was, didn't really feel comfortable around you as he knew you were a writer, but the, you know, anyone that, you know, coming across people on here that have met him and you know, would just, you know, hang around kind of, you know, and tried to catch him and grabbed a beer with him, whatever. When there isn't cameras and when there is no microphones, apparently lovely guy, like loveliest guy you could meet, and just always happy to chat. I mean, and, you know.
Yeah, no, he is. He's absolutely fine. He's got a good heart on him, Liam. And I mean, one of the things I was trying to do in both Getting High and Forever the People was to say this guy is not a dickhead.
Yeah.
You know, the perception of him was this drunken dickhead. You know, and I was trying to say he's actually, you know, he's very sharp. I mean, funny. You know, really funny. I mean, I don't know if I put it in, but there was one bit we were at Knowles, and it was getting near Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
It was like coming up the bonfire night, and Halloween was around the corner, and we were at Knowles, and me and Liam were talking, and we looked up, and on the TV screen was this documentary about the Ku Klux Klan. So there's all these images of guys with white hoods and burning crosses, and Liam goes, they're taking Halloween a bit seriously, isn't they?
Did he know the Ku Klux Klan though, or was it just a good line?
No, I don't know. That's the brilliant thing about it. Simon was he was a producer on the Supersonic doc. He said he went to Germany with Liam, and Liam said, "Yeah, you know, one of the problems is you know, because asking about Noel, and he said one of the problems is people who are small." And then he looked at the crowd and went, "Not your little fella."
Oh, God.
He's funny, and he's got, you know, a good heart on him.
There's a great...
But they also got into that. I mean, what disappointed me on that Be Here Now tour was that they got into this Mank thing.
Right.
Whereas I always thought, you know, it was all about, you know, because they were so, you know, so I became the Cockney.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even from London. Yeah, Cockney, Cockney, you know, I don't like Cockney, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like... I thought the whole thing was to escape where you're from, liberation, freedom, do you know what I mean? For them to be who you want to be, where you want to be, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And
it just become very cynical and, you know, like I say, a machine, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't... That's
why you're not going to write the book.
No, because also, if I'd been there...
Yeah.
If I'd been there doing what I did on those first two books, reporting like that, then yeah, you could do it, because it would... Even if they were making Duff albums, I'm sure they'd still be funny as. But I'd sort of, you know, I'd bailed out by then. So
yeah. I mean, do you still keep in touch with Noel or any of the other guys?
No. I saw him about a year ago at a mutual friend's party, and he was absolutely fine, and we talked, and you know, absolutely fine. But you know, he's moved on, so have I. You know.
Yeah, no, fair play. Good. All right, well, the book's still up for being done by someone else then. There we go.
Sorry about that.
I've the one thing I want from them is more of a musicologist, like the, you know, Revolution in the Head, Ian McDonald's book on the Beatles. You know, because while the, you know, while the out there was definitely a dip in the, you know, the relevance and the songwriting, but still there's still really good stuff to explore in those. And actually into the later albums, they are very, very well produced, you know, especially the last album, Dig Out Your Soul. It's a phenomenal piece of production, you know. It's just that the underlying songs just aren't, you know, and as I say, it's not the same.
What's the best song on that Dig Out Your Soul album?
Dig Out Your Soul, I would say the first four songs are great. So there's one called The Turning, there's one called Bag It Up. Liam does a very good song actually that he wrote himself called I'm Out of Time. Can get myself some peace of mind. You know it's getting hard to fly. If I'm to fall, would you be there to applaud? Or would you hide behind the mall? If I had to go, in my heart you cry. But the problem with all those, the later albums, is that, yeah, you get in, I've said this on the podcast a few times, so skip if you're listening. The key for me is Noel writing the song and his brother Liam singing it, right? That was the magic. And then in the later albums, Liam starts writing, Gem's writing, Andy Bell's writing, and Noel's doing, Noel's singing his own song. So Noel will be singing three or four songs. So you end up only, so on that Dig Out Your Soul, there's like maybe three or four songs that Noel wrote and Liam sings. And you're like, that's not what we want, you know? So that's why if you make a playlist of literally just the songs that Noel wrote and Liam sang, it's great, you know? And then similarly, you know, there's certain songs earlier in the career that Liam does backing vocals on. And he sounds great. Liam as a backing vocalist is just the most phenomenal sound to come in the background. Like when Lennon's doing backing vocals on a McCartney tune, but he just doesn't do them anymore. And you know, it's in those later years he wasn't even in the studio. He would just come in, do his vocals, and go. You know, and that's it.
That's what it did become like that. That's what made a machine. You know,
yeah,
service
a machine. Yeah. But there you go. Anyway, so that's Oasis. But I'll ping you over that. I'll ping you over that playlist, mate. But it is
there's stuff to enjoy
in the later years, absolutely. The other thing I was going to touch on, because I've got sitting in front of me two tomes that I kind of have relied on a lot in my life, which is The Soul Stylists and then The Sharper Word, a mod anthology.
Okay.
And the reason why is that I haven't mentioned this on the podcast, and people always have a go at me because I apparently talk about it too much, but I actually was on Mastermind in 2008, and my specialist subject was the mod movement in Britain.
No, you're joking.
I promise, mate. I'll send you my mod round is on YouTube, so I'll ping you the link of me doing answering questions.
How many points you get?
I got like 16 out of 17.
And your chosen subject?
The mod movement in Britain.
The mods in 2 minutes, starting now. Which of the two makes of motor scooter favoured by the mods has a name meaning wasp in Italian?
Vespa.
Correct. Which Friday night television pop music show, whose slogan was "The weekend starts here," was a showcase for the latest music and fashion?
Ready, steady, go.
Yes. At Easter 1964, which East Coast resort became the scene of the first confrontation between the police and mods and rockers?
Clacton.
When 97 arrests were made?
Clacton.
Yes. I'm the Face was on the A side of the only single released by The Who in their incarnation as The High Numbers. What was on the B side?
Zoot Suit.
Yes. In March 64, which celebrated mod band played on the last night of the Marquee Club's old Oxford Street premises and the opening night of its new Wardour Street premises?
The Who.
The Yardbirds. Which character in Quadrophenia is said to have been based on Irish Jack, a mod and friend of Pete Townsend?
Jimmy.
Yes. In 2003, the Ministry of Defence became involved in a dispute with a clothing company over the use of which symbol that had been the mod's trademark since the 60s?
The RAF Roundel.
Yes. Which Birmingham-based mod revivalist topped the album charts in 97 with Marchin' Already?
Ocean Colour Scene.
Yes. What was the name of the Glaswegian who came to London when he was 18, is widely credited with turning Carnaby Street into the fashion centre it became?
John Stevens.
Yes. What's the title of the 1959 novel by Colin McGuinness, which was turned into a musical film released in 86, that captures the mod scene at its birth?
Absolute Beginners.
Yes. What was the name of the club that opened in Brasenose Street, Manchester in 63? It was a popular mods venue.
The Twisted Wheel.
Yes. The term Northern Soul is said to have been coined by which writer and champion of black music in articles that he wrote for the magazine Blues and Soul in 1970?
Dave Godding.
Yes. Which company produced the original Desert Boots, a lightweight boot with an upper made of suede that were favoured by mods?
Clarks.
Yes. What was the name of the music publicist who briefly managed The Who in their early days and described mod culture as clean living under difficult circumstances?
Pete Meaden.
Yes. Which magazine interviewed Mark Bell, later known as Mark Bolan, for an article published in 62 that was one of the first public recognitions of the mod scene?
Town.
Yes. Which mod group formed in Ouseley in the early 1960s and was the guitarist Ronnie Wood's first band?
The Birds.
Yes, Thunderbirds. In which town was the casino club that during the 70s was one of the centres of Northern Soul?
Wigan.
Wigan is correct. No passes. James Corcoran, 16 points.
I went to the second round and I did Billy Bragg in the second round, and I got I did okay on Billy Bragg, but I basically, you come across proper quizzes at that point.
What was the hardest question for the mod thing?
The mod questions were pretty easy. The only one I got wrong was what was the last band to play the Marquee before it closed? And I think I said The Who and it was The Yardbirds or something like that. But basically, all they do for Mastermind is that you tell them the subject, you apply online and they phone you and then you have a chat through and then they tell you Basically, if you pick the subject, you tell them the three or four books you're going to use. And so basically, because otherwise what they don't want to do is you know, completely throw you with stuff you haven't got a prayer of knowing. So basically, I picked out, you know, Mods by Terry Barnes and your couple of your books and Mod Richard Barnes, and then Mod A Very British Phenomenon. And that was my books. And so I had to just memorize them because, you know, they could pick a question from any of those books at any point.
Right.
But what I did was basically read them all with flashcards, and then as I came up, I thought, oh, that's interesting, make a note of it in the form of a question. And basically, and that's how I kind of did it and how I sort of revised.
Yeah, good thing,
and I crushed it. You know, I did, as I say, 16 out of 17. But it was pretty easy. But it was easy, you know. I mean, any...
Well, I was watching it one time, and the special subject is Tottenham Hotspur, this girl.
All right.
And I think I got 14 out of 17.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. If you, you know, you just need to, because you nominate the books, is you just gen up on it, and as long as, you know, they're not going to throw you any complete curveballs, but, but anyway, so there we go. So yeah, so I absolutely hammered those books kind of in that period. But I mean, I've always found it, I wouldn't necessarily classify myself as a mod. I mean, I don't spend the money to go out and look like a mod. But I'm just more of a historian of that scene. I've always loved it. I've always just find
that... That's the, do you know what? I mean, that's where I was coming from with it. Because what happened with me, because I was in the children's home, when the Swedehead thing hit Woking in 72, I couldn't buy all the clothes.
Yeah.
Because suddenly all my mates, we were 12, 13, suddenly they were young men.
Mm.
With their Ben Shermans and their Stay Pressed trousers and their brogues and loafers and Crombie, they just look like young men. It's just like, wow, such an impact on me. But I didn't have the money. I got, I think, 2 shillings a week pocket money. There's no way I could, you know, buy these clothes. So because of that, when I finally started earning money at Melody Maker, I started buying those clothes then. And then I started looking into the history of it, like through Richard Barnes, and then thinking, there's this whole kind of accepted thing about music, which goes, you know, Elvis, the Beatles, the Stones, you know, Dylan, blah, 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 which is obviously, you know, it's rock culture, and obviously that's a very important thing. But there's another story, which is jazz, Ronnie Scott, the Sing Club, you know, Pete Meaden, Small Faces, Otis Redding, you know, Skinheads, you know, Soul Boys, you know, the whole thing. So that's where the... You know, that, but also, I say that the idea of Solstice, as well as idea, that was his title. He explained the concept to me one day, I said, well, we should do a book, and that's how that came about. But the thing, the strength of the Solstice really isn't really about me, it's about the people I spoke to.
Yeah.
Because their testimonies, I mean, they're just fantastic. Wish I'd got more. I mean, it's just... I mean, I was very, very chuffed because Iggy Crosdale, who's huge on the Northern Soul scene, said to me, well, your chapter on Northern Soul is one of the best I've ever read, and I feel really proud about that because those guys are very hard to please.
Well, tell me about it, mate. After I did Mod on Mastermind, I turned up with, you know, I probably spent more time picking what I was going to wear than I did revising on it, because I thought the mods are going to tear me to shreds, you know. And this is 2008, so it's, you know, internet's around and you know, the mod culture, you know, forum is pretty big.
Yeah.
And you know, and so I turned up with a couple of different sort of t-shirt choices and shirt choices, but they all had logos on them. You know, and basically, I didn't even realise, but the BBC was like, oh, no, you can't have that Duff of St George. I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then you can't have that. And so they said, well, I said, that's all I've got. He said, all right, well, you have to go and get something from wardrobe. So I ended up just picking like a random sort of ill-fitting brown shirt that was probably, you know, because it was filmed in Granada Studios in Manchester, probably something that, you know, someone of Coronation Street wears, you know. And then, and so I've kind of, you know, it's quite smart trousers and shoes. I'm wearing this crappy brown shirt. And then all this, I said, I'm like searching for myself and seeing what people have thought about it online. And it's all these mods going, yeah, he did all right on the questions, but fucking hell, what was he wearing? like, help me out, guys, come on.
But
no, anyway, that was fun. But I'll ping you the link over. But that was a real good laugh, and it was good fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what? So I mean, you've so what are you up to next? What's the next things we should be looking out for from?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I've done this book called On the Dawn of Your First Smile, and it's like a open letter to my son. I've had a boy called Raffi. It's had a huge impact on me, and the book is kind of not comparing, but kind of talking about my past as opposed to whatever. You know, the past, I'm going to try and build him. Do you know what I mean? And it was inspired by Oscar Wilde, actually. And Oscar wrote an amazing piece of work called Deep Profundus, right. A letter he wrote to his boyfriend from prison in 1872, I think. No, 1892. And he and that, I'd always loved that piece of writing. So I kind of, that kind of inspired that. And then the second one is... a Ronnie Lane biog, which was crowdfunded, and I've done with John Hellier, who I did the Steve Murray book with.
Yeah.
And yes, that's going to come out. That's been pledged. That's been funded. Crowdfunded. So those guys who pledged for it, guys and girls, will get it on. When will they get it? July, August, and then hopefully a paper acquisition will come out in September.
Great. So you did Steve, you're doing Ronnie now. Are you going to go on and do Kenny and Mac?
No, that's it now. I mean, the thing was, I've done it as an oral history.
Yeah.
So it's quotes, you know, because I can't write any more about the small faces. There's nothing more to be said about.
Is there anything
you know
left?
What I mean? Yeah, there's nothing left to say. It's all done and dusted. So, So,
fair enough. And then what about, I mean, I really enjoyed Heaven's Promise as well, you know, your novel that you wrote. And I thought it was, because it just, I mean, it was, you know, that sort of scene was, I'm a bit younger for not having been in that scene, but I really feel that, you know, your writing kind of style had this sort of, you know, snap to it that just kind of summed up that feeling of that, you know, the what was happening in London around that time, and I really liked it. I mean, weren't any other plans for more creative any like novels?
No, not at the moment, because it's to be honest with you, it's very hard to get books off the ground these days. Really, really difficult. So what I'm kind of, you know. I'd probably look more towards trying to get into film and TV scripts, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, great.
Because it's just, there's money there and there's not a lot of money in books at the moment. So, but do you know what, James, who knows? Who knows, mate? I mean, if 3 years ago you said to me, you will be looking after a 20-month-old son called Raffi and boring people stupid because you think he's going to play for Tottenham Hotspur and writing a 20,000-word book about him, I'd have gone, you want to stop taking those drugs, mate? You know what I mean? So who knows where we're going to be in 3 years' time, you know?
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. All right, mate. Well, that's absolutely brilliant. So I will play out with the song of your choice. So what, any song in particular, whether it's an Oasis or a Faces
track?
Well,
we've come up with an Oasis one, haven't we? And for me, they're best shot easily by Miles, The Master Plan.
The Master Plan. Good. Yeah. Well, Paolo, that's absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today. I do really, really appreciate it.
No worries.
And it'd be good to stay in touch because this podcast has been going for a sort of couple of months now, but it's already kind of picking up quite a bit of steam. We're going to start doing live stuff, and Brian Cannon's sort of been involved already, and it's exciting.
I will send him my best when you see him.
I will, mate. But
good.
Paolo, all the best, mate. Thank you so much for your time.
You as well, mate. Take care of yourself.
Cheers. Bye.
Ciao.
We'll dance if they want to dance. Please, brother, take a chance. You know they
got?
I've got three.
Fucking hell, man. I've got one and it's done my head in.
Well, you've done it a little bit. You've done a little bit later in life than I have, mate. I'm 37. I'd started relatively early.
It's very good of you to say a little later in life, a lot later in life.
Some people that, you know, that have done it a bit later in life, I think it does get hard if you've had a lot of, you know, your own way for a long time. I went straight into it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. He's top, man. He's 20 months and he's kicking with both feet. And he volleys the ball. He loves football. So what more do you need?
That was.
I've already got him signed to Tottenham. He's already replaced Dele Alli in my mind. You know. So
that's it. Is it okay? Fair enough.
It's terrible, man. But because he is. He's very good at football. He's 20 months old and he's really good at football. And of course, you know, your brain just goes, doesn't it? You think, oh my God,
that's
it. This, that. I mean, he takes a ball to bed.
Oh wow. Good.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? That's what I mean. So I'm looking at this thinking, actually, last person I heard about who could ball the bed was Lionel Messi.
Yeah. Well, that's George Best as well. That was what they said about Bestie, so.
Yeah, that's another one, yeah. So, great. My son's going to end up an alcoholic with one liver.
But as long as he has a good time along the way, that's all that matters.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Good. Yeah. Nice one.